Habitats of birds in many parts of the world have been altered due to the expansion of agriculture over the past two centuries. The grey teal duck of Australia is no exception, and has faced a major change in its habitats in the Murray-Darling Basin due to the introduction of rice cultivation. This episode of the Exploring Environmental History podcast explores the history of ducks and rice fields in the Murrumbidgee River region in Australia. I'm Jan Oosthoek. Australia is the driest non-frozen continent on the planet. Antarctica is drier, but mostly covered in ice. Being the driest continent positioned around the Tropic of Capricorn has its consequences for water distribution as well as the behavior of rivers and ecologies in Australia. Australian ecologies can generally be characterized as boom and bust, and are significantly driven by intermittent and unpredictable wet booms and dry busts. The populations and movements of many animals are considerably influenced by these wet and dry periods. Most Australian birds, for example, are not driven by the winter and summer migrations so familiar to North Americans and Europeans. Birds tend to be nomadic, in that they go where the water and consequently the food is. Native Australian ducks are no exception, and their movements are considerably driven by dry and wet periods. Before the arrival of Europeans and their agriculture, ducks only had to compete with other native birds and animals, as well as Aboriginal hunters. However, the introduction of water-intensive agricultural activity, such as rice growing, has changed the landscape of most river systems in Australia, in particular that of the Murray-Darling system in relation to rice cultivation. My guest on this podcast is Emily O'Gorman, Associate Research Fellow at the Australian Centre for Cultural Environmental Research at the University of Wollongong, who recently presented a paper at the University of Queensland entitled Remaking Wetlands, A History of Ducks and Rice Fields in the Murrumbidgee River Region, New South Wales. Emily is an expert on Australian flooding and river history, and she will examine the ways in which the changing water landscapes of the Murrumbidgee River caused by the creation of rice paddies were negotiated by ducks as well as people. Okay, Emily, welcome on the podcast.
Thank you.
Let's first start with the subjects of your work. First of all, you talk about a river, and that's the Murrumbidgee River. Where is it situated, and what's the relation to ducks under pre-colonial regimes?
The Murrumbidgee River is located in the southeast of the Murray-Darling Basin, which is, that basin is a large river basin, which covers about a seventh of Australia and most of inland eastern Australia. Quite a big area. And the Murrumbidgee River is actually a tributary of the Murray River, and it's in New South Wales. So the Murrumbidgee, like many other rivers in the basin, experiences both large floods and also periods of intense drying. So sometimes it can dry up completely. And floods are really important along the river. During floods, biodiversity in wetlands, as well as along rivers and on floodplains, increases as floods trigger breeding cues for many plants and animals. The populations and movements of most species of native ducks are considerably influenced by these wet and dry periods. The ducks are in varying degrees nomadic, that is, rather than having a seasonal migration, for example, as ducks in North America do, they flock to rivers and wetlands that are in flood to feed, nest, and also breed. So the species of ducks, I'll just go through them quickly, that visit the Murrumbidgee region include grey teal, Pacific black duck, pink-eared duck, Australian wood duck, which is also called a mangoose. And this bird is actually closer to species of geese than duck, but it's kind of its own thing. And the white-eyed duck and some others, but they're kind of the main ones. And the population of each of these species significantly increases during floods as females hatch several broods in a few months and then crashes during droughts as breeding slows. While breeding can occur at any time of year, the spring river rises in the Murrumbidgee as well as the Murray River mean ducks have often bred, as they still do, in these months, but more so during really large floods.
During the 20th century, this kind of natural pattern is changed because humans significantly alter the flow pattern in the catchment of the Murrumbidgee River, and of course all over Australia and in all rivers. Can you tell us more about the changes that were made in the river landscape, in particular related to rice growing?
In the 20th century, many large dams were built throughout the, as you say, Australia and also the Murray-Darling Basin in attempts to really control the variable flows of these rivers, largely for irrigated agriculture. And today the region is a really important food-producing area for Australia. In recent years, water and land management in this area has become an increasingly controversial topic in Australia. In broad terms, the most prevalent issue is perhaps the conflicting water needs of established agricultural farms and industries and the ramifying ecological consequences of these water extractions. So the Murrumbidgee River has been central in these recent debates. It was a really important site of agricultural expansion and it supports quite extensive irrigation areas. The dams that kind of regulate the river include the Burrinjuck Dam, which is quite big, and the Snowy Mountains Hydroelectric Scheme, which is quite famous in Australia and maybe around the world. In recent years, almost all rice grown in Australia has been grown in three irrigation areas. The Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area, which I'll mostly be talking about, the Collyambly Irrigation Area, which also draws water from the Murrumbidgee River, and the Murray Valley Irrigation Districts, which are located on the Murray River. Of these areas, the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area grows the most rice and is where commercial rice growing in this region began, which was around the mid-1920s. The main varieties of rice grown in these areas, all of these areas, are traditionally flood irrigated, meaning that crops need to be flooded at particular times in their growth cycle to ensure high yields and also to control weeds. The relatively high water requirements of the crop has led to its cultivation being heavily critiqued within broader national debates about water management. Most pressingly, there are a number of wetlands along the Murrumbidgee, such as the Lower Murrumbidgee floodplain, that are important sites for bird breeding. And these have received reduced amounts of water due to upstream irrigation extractions for this and other agricultural products. The loss of wetland habitat has led to an overall decline in numbers of some duck species like grey teal throughout eastern Australia in the last three decades. But the changing water landscapes of the Murrumbidgee and other river regions have also been inhabited by water birds in some surprising ways. For instance, populations of wood duck and Pacific black duck have increased in recent years, partly through their inhabitation of increasing numbers of farm dams. Similarly, ducks have been attracted to flooded rice fields as both drought refuges and as aquatic habitat during local floods. And the rice fields have kind of acted like a wetland in some ways for ducks. But the sharing of space and resources by agriculture and wildlife has meant that there's been a lot of conflict around the ways ducks can and can't be accommodated in these agricultural spaces.
From your paper, I understand that there is an important social history behind the creation of rice production in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, and this relates to immigration as well as food production policies. Can you briefly sketch this important episode of social and agricultural history?
Well, agricultural expansion in the 20th century throughout Australia was motivated by a range of political and cultural ideas. At the beginning of the 20th century, they included long-held ideologies and governments of closer settlement or the benefits of closer settlement for more intensive production, particularly of food, as well as the economic fallout of what is now known as the Federation Drought, which was a really long drought that lasted from approximately 1895 to 1901 and kind of devastated pastoralism in Australia and in eastern Australia. So within these kind of contexts, the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area began operation in 1912. It was conceived and kind of began operation early that century. And it was a state government administered irrigation area that was intended to produce food from small, intensively cultivated farms. Production plans for the scheme included blocks for horticulture, dairying, lucerne, and raising pigs and fat lambs. Racially motivated ideas about desirable immigrants were reflected in the government's recruitment of farmers from the USA and Europe, as well as elsewhere in Australia. And this was the era of the White Australia policy. But as farmers began cultivation, it soon became clear that many of the crops were unsuitable for intensive farming in the area, and soil salinity became a really significant problem and was so severe in some places that farmers abandoned their flocks. Local Aboriginal people, Wiradjuri, in the area also experienced significant upheaval in this period following the often violent frontier conflicts between mostly Anglo-Celtic colonists and Wiradjuri that reached its height in the late 1830s. Many Wiradjuri had taken up employment on the pastoral properties that had dominated the region from the 1840s, mostly as a means to stay on country. But as intensive irrigation began being established, more Wiradjuri moved on to missions or to places outside of these intensively cultivated areas. Pretty soon after it was established, the irrigation area, it was bordering on failure with the failure of a number of crops and other products that had planned to be grown there. And rice actually became one of a number of agricultural products under trial by farmers and the state government to replace the unsuccessful products. Other varieties were trialled from Japan, for instance, but it wasn't until Californian varieties were trialled in the early 1920s that rice really moved into commercial production. And the first commercial crop was in 1924. And even though the crop needed a lot of water, it was seen as desirable because it was utilising areas that were previously seen as unproductive. So it was mostly grown on clay soils that held water well that other crops kind of hadn't really been grown on before.
So it was actually a case of making good economic use of soils that were all very productive.
Yeah,
that's something we see around the globe, and yeah. I've seen it in my own research related to forestry in Scotland, where forestry was used to make unproductive areas productive.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a success coming out of a failure, and that's the way it was kind of represented.
So the creation of the Murrumbidgee irrigation area and the rice field seems to have also created a situation in which humans had to share the newly created rice wetlands with ducks. How did the emergence of these irrigated areas for rice growing change the ducks' behavior? I mean, you already alluded to that there was a problem there. And what was the response of the farmers?
Well, the ducks seem to have really treated the rice fields just as some extra aquatic habitat. So they turned up in the first commercial rice season. And during the season, so that was in 1924, and farmers reported damage to crops from ducks to the Australian Museum, which was located in Sydney. And they requested a special open season on ducks in order to, as a form of pest control. But the museum recommended to the Chief Secretary or the Government of New South Wales, so Chief Secretary of New South Wales, who was responsible for declaring open seasons, they recommended that the open seasons currently in place in the region from February to April not be altered to better suit the times when rice was most vulnerable, which was from approximately September to February. And this seems to be due to concerns that hunting across the spring and summer months would coincide with the peak of the ducks' nesting seasons, and not hunting during breeding seasons, particularly for birds like ducks, was really tied to gaming interests and maintaining kind of duck populations for hunting. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later.
It's here actually that you allude to the Australian Museum, the scientists get involved. So what debates were going on in the scientific community during the interwar period? Because the debates about ducks and rice fields are, as my impression from your paper, were embedded in a wider debate about the relation between native animals and agriculture. How Europeans were perceiving these native animals.
Native ducks were really included in 19th century legislation under the general category of wild ducks of any species, and this was within the broader category of native game as opposed to imported game such as pheasants. Both native and imported game birds were protected under colonial laws that aimed to limit overhunting. For native birds, this was to prevent destruction by enforcing a closed season during what was understood to be the breeding season. And for imported birds, it was so that they could establish and maintain populations for hunting, as I mentioned. From the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, arguments for the protection of birds in Australia increasingly centred on their value to farming, in addition to hunting interests. And this shift was reflected in the protection of insectivorous birds, which ate insect pests, in various New South Wales state acts. Historians Peter Jarman and Margaret Brock have argued that this change was partly due to an intense drought in the late 1880s and 1890s, which brought the economic and environmental effects of intense overstocking of sheep and widespread tree clearing by graziers into focus for both governments and farmers. And with it, a realisation that pastoral land use practices needed to change because of the environmental degradation that was happening. Another argument is that the now largely native-born Anglo-Celtic population had a better appreciation of native flora and fauna than previous generations of mostly European migrants. With these and maybe other motivations, across this period, some sectors of government and advocates of conservation looked to scientists for information on the economic relationship between animals, birds, and agriculture. And this was partly to counter accusations by opponents of conservation that animal and bird protection was merely sentimental. So arguments for the economic value of birds were arguments for their protection within this framework on these grounds. And publications of scientific research into the economic role of birds in agriculture, for instance, in eating invertebrates, proliferated in the 1920s and 1930s. And this was a topic that the biologists who kind of got involved in early research on the relationships between ducks and rice got interested in.
Let's go back to the mid-20th century, because after the Second World War, there was an intensification expansion of the rice cultivation as part of the food security program of the government. This Yeah. raised some concerns among biologists about the impacts on birds, and also led to research that laid the groundwork for understanding the dynamic between rice growing, ducks, and flooding as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about the findings and the importance of this research?
Across the early part of the 20th century, since rice kind of began to be grown, there had been special open seasons eventually became declared in which farmers could apply to shoot ducks at any time of year as a kind of pest control following concerns that were raised after World War II as agriculture expanded. These special open seasons were stopped, but it kind of changed again in 1952, when a rice shortage was attributed to duck damage. And following a visit to the rice areas, the Chief Secretary, who was responsible for declaring open seasons, Chief Secretary of New South Wales, he declared a special open season again, which started on 1 September and lasted for 5 months. So it was quite an open season. And at the same time, the Irrigation Research and Extension Committee, a government department, on behalf of the Rice Growers Association, which had been established as rice expanded, requested the Commonwealth Government to investigate the bionomics of wild ducks in the irrigation areas. And this was begun by someone called Harry Frith in 1952. Frith did this within the Wildlife Survey section of the Commonwealth Science and Industrial Research Organisation, which was at the time headed by Francis Radcliffe since its creation in 1949, and was in fact a section which Frith later headed. Since the mid-1940s, Frith has actually been engaged in agricultural research in the area. So this was kind of his chance to move into wildlife research. And his research was requested by the Rice Growers Association, who kind of dismissed other reports at this stage, but by biologists who had said that ducks weren't actually doing that much damage on the rice farms, contrary to what some farmers had claimed. And they dismissed these reports because they thought that the research wasn't extensive enough, and Frith's research really kind of was thorough and lasted for a number of years through to 1956, so 4 years. And this involved gizzard analysis of 1,849 ducks, as well as field observations. And the species Frith concentrated on were wood duck and grey teal black duck, as well as white-eyed duck. Frith found that as earlier biologists had, that a division of opinion existed amongst the growers themselves about whether the ducks damage crops or help them. And he also found that farming practices were more generally important in limiting crop damage than hunting ducks as a kind of pest control. He argued that the damage attributed to ducks from puddling the soils and other activities was often able to be traced to the same farming practices that other biologists had also described, which led to patches where no rice germinated. In addition, he identified the problem of destruction from wind. Most importantly, Frith argued that bare patches of the crop from poor germination rates created good landing places for ducks, who could settle there and widen the opening by pushing down the encircling plants. And he observed that even well-grown crops of rice were very rarely visited by the birds. He also actually researched both the Murrumbidgee irrigation area and the newer Murray Valley irrigation districts, which had been established during and expanded after World War II. In his research, he kind of implied that farming practices and thus damage was worse in the more recent rice growing areas because farmers had not as good crops, I suppose. Their farming skills weren't, they hadn't been farming rice as long, and so their farming skills weren't as good, and so ducks were attracted to the badly farmed fields. Whereas in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, which had now been growing rice for more than 30 years, there was less duck damage happening. His argument was supported by the fact that special open seasons were only declared in the newer rice areas each year from 1953 to 1957. In response to complaints by farmers, and not in the older areas. In any case, in both places, Frith found that while different ducks fed on rice at different stages in the plant's growth, the damage was not extensive, and that overall wild ducks are not a serious pest of rice crops. Another major aspect of Frith's work was linking the booms in duck population with floods. So while there had been a general understanding amongst biologists and farmers that ducks followed floods, Frith's research on their responses laid much of the groundwork for later research on their nomadic behaviour. And during the time that he was doing his research, there were a number of floods in the area, so he kind of observed the birds coming in, and he kind of thought that the general increase in ducks in the Murrumbidgee region during floods was really a reason that perhaps farmers had assigned or blame them for damaging rice crops just because there were so many all at once. Yeah, so he kind of was pointing to perhaps a more complex situation going on, you know, with farming practices, and he also kind of suggested that other birds might also be eating rice. So he was kind of expanding, you know, it wasn't really just about ducks eating rice. He was kind of drawing attention to a more complex situation.
Yeah, so this actually points to a transition, you can say, in the biological sciences, especially driven by government initiatives, from, you know, a more passive way of looking at biology, you know, taxonomy of the 19th century, to the emergence of more dynamic systems of more modern ecology in the post-war period. So what's the relevance of this story for present-day discussions surrounding agriculture, pests and hunting?
Well, following Frith's research, so from the 1950s, special open seasons on ducks and rice areas have continued to be declared for most years, for several months across the Australian summer, as they still are. And just as an interesting note, an interesting contrast, throughout the rest of the state, open seasons on ducks were effectively banned or were put on hold, so effectively banned from 1995. So that's in New South Wales. It's a different story in other states. But this ban kind of responded to growing concerns among many groups around the ethics of hunting for sport. But in the rice areas, most other aspects of the debates around ducks eating rice have continued, and the damage that they can do to crops. I think these controversies around ducks and rice fields show some of the inherited relationships between particular crops, farmers, and the ducks, and the ways in which these relationships have continued to be negotiated in a changing water landscape. Most farmers have really remained convinced that ducks damage crops. There is really still no definite consensus amongst farmers or between farmers and biologists about whether ducks actually damage crops. Part of these continued debates may be different ideas about what has constituted acceptable damage. In the case of Frith and an earlier biologist, some farmers may have seen their recommendations as top-down science, so coming from the Australian Museum, coming from Commonwealth Science and Industrial Research Organisation. And so these kind of researchers reflected only a portion of the views of the farming community and may have unwittingly entered into regional politics where there's a lot more going on. But as rice farming has come under increasing scrutiny in recent years for its traditionally high water use farming methods, the aquatic habitat created by the fields has been used to help justify the crop. And the Rice Growers Association of Australia has publicly available brochures about biodiversity on rice farms. There's an element of strategy by rice growers in presenting their farms this way during a period of heightened criticism to show that the water used on the farms is used for more than one thing. These efforts can be seen as a new negotiation by farmers for sharing these water landscapes. But interestingly, ducks haven't been included as kind of, you know, representative of biodiversity on rice farms. And I think that really points to the kind of inherited relationship between farmers and the ducks and water. In a 1997 report, some ecologists suggested that duck decoy feeding areas could help attract ducks away from rice crops. These are essentially dams with vegetation that would appeal to ducks, much like the wildlife-friendly farm dams that have been encouraged by a range of organisations and by the New South Wales government over the last decade and a half. While these don't seem to have been widely taken up by farmers, perhaps because of water shortages during drought through most of the 2000s across eastern Australia, to 2012, however, there were signs of these kind of wildlife-friendly dams that ducks were enjoying. I saw them when I went out there. But there's also a range of problems with these dams, such as the dams being on private land and subject to private interest. But I think they also perhaps represent a more hopeful possibility for ways that these water landscapes can be shared.
So let's move on to the final bit of this podcast. Sure. Since we are talking rivers, I would like to turn to your recently published book, Flood Country, an Environmental History of the Murray-Darling Basin. Although Australia is a very dry country, it has some big rivers that carry most of the time or quite modest amounts of water compared to other big rivers in the world. But when in flood, these rivers really carry enormous amounts of water and they can be very destructive. Of course, the recent floods in 2011 and 12 really demonstrated that. So, and the public response also was very interesting. And people kind of refer to them as rare events, but that seems a bit odd to me, looking at, well, what I know about flooding and flood history in Australia, that they seem to occur at least twice in the human lifetime. So your book is exploring the complex history between the rivers of the Murray-Darling Basin and human culture. Is this perception of floods as a rare event a recent thing, or has it a longer history?
Well, I suppose I should start by saying that floods, as well as droughts, these kind of wet and dry periods, are really highly irregular in Australia, and they're really influenced by, as we hear about in recent years, El Niño, Southern Oscillation, and they're not annual. They kind of happen, you know, very intermittently, very irregularly. But it's interesting, I think, this sense of surprise as well, because they do happen. You know, they're not that uncommon. And since settler colonisation, it's really been an ongoing theme in Australia. In my book, I trace changing understandings of floods in the Murray-Darling Basin from about 1850 through to the early 2000s, looking at different flood events across that period and across that large area. One in 1852 in Gundagai in New South Wales, one in 1890 in Bourke, also in New South Wales on the Darling River, in 1956 on the Murray River, and then in 1990 up in Cunnamulla. And in each of those studies, as well as other floods that have happened that I also kind of look at in between those periods, this sense of surprise is a clear aspect of each of these events. But there's also a sense, I think, after these events that the big event has now passed and there won't be another one for many years. So I think there's kind of a complacency around that. I think another factor is the recentness of colonial cultures of knowledge and the way that flood knowledge is accumulated. So flood records are constantly being broken is probably the best way to put it. You know, there's always a bigger flood happening, and I think it's part of that recentness of the scientific data collection and data records, which are authoritative within Western cultures, within the kind of cultures we are living in. But also, I mean, across the period of the last 160 years, there's also been a huge number of cultural and environmental changes. So towns, cities, new animals, plants, sheep and cattle, large dams, irrigation networks being built. So as people have been experiencing floods and gaining knowledge of river flows and floodplains, they've also been, the rivers and floodplains have been undergoing quite radical local changes, apart from any changes from climate change. So experiences and knowledge of one flood might not translate to the next one because the flows can be quite different. I think probably as a last point, a lot of river engineering has been geared towards drought proofing and to a lesser extent flood proofing. I'm doing scare quotes. I know this is audio. Drought proofing and flood proofing cities, towns, farms, industries. So another aspect of the surprise element is of yet another flood or another drought is that in many cases a sense of security had been created that these events won't happen again. And I think the recent Brisbane floods are a good case of that, where flood mitigation dams had been built and there was a sense that the city was now floodproof. And this massive flood happened and really took people by surprise because there was a real conviction that the city was floodproof.
It's interesting that these debates are not only ongoing about, you know, we have had the biggest flood, so it's not going to happen anytime soon again, are also happening in Europe, in non-settler societies. For example, in Scotland, there, especially in the rivers in the north, people always say, oh, well, we've had the biggest flood somewhere in the 1950s. It's not going to happen for another, 500 years or 1,000 years. And then it happened again within 20 years. So that even there, they don't have full records because they only started to measure the water heights in these rivers during the 20th century. So it's not just the settler societies that have not a long record. It's also the European societies that have actually forgotten how big these floods can be. Yeah. And it's a task for historians to figure out how bad it can get. Yeah. Not only historians, but also earth scientists and geomorphologists.
Changes in the way floods are recorded means that earlier kind of ways of maybe recording flood heights aren't easily translated into the newer kind of ways of, the new kind of technology or the new ways of recording floods.
So it's a lot of more research is needed to get a better understanding of, you know, how we experienced floods in the past, how it was recorded, how bad they were, things like that. Unfortunately, we don't have more time to explore these themes in more detail. So, Emily, I would like to thank you very much for discussing your very interesting work and for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Emily O'Gorman's book Flood Country, An Environmental History of the Murray-Darling Basin is published by CSIRO Publishing and can be bought both as hard copy and ebook from their website at www.publish.csiro.au. A link to the actual page of the book is available on the podcast page of the Environmental History Resources website. This was the last episode of 2012, and I hope that you will join me in the new year for new episodes of Exploring Environmental History. This is Jan Oosthoek from Brisbane, Australia.